This is another episode of the Decoding Purpose podcast. My name is Rebecca Tapp, and in every episode of Decoding Purpose, we speak to humans of both influence and impact to explore how life's turning points help us to decode purpose and to ignite a more meaningful and purpose-driven life. Welcome to another episode of the Decoding Purpose podcast. This is The Turning Point, a series of Decoding Purpose dedicated to helping you and your business to navigate this pandemic with purpose. A few weeks ago, an email landed in my inbox with a quick note insisting that I track down and interview today's guest. I am so glad that I followed the lead because I discovered an incredible thinker and thought leader by the name of David Burkus. The title of his new book, Pick a Fight, How Great Teams Find a Purpose Worth Rallying Around. Now, this is a book that would have jumped off the shelf at me in any context, really, given my obsession for decoding purpose. But this book was a real standout. See, it offered a new perspective for me. It unlocked personal motivations and looked at what it takes to form a passionate army around a world-changing mission. And let's face it, the timing of this book couldn't be better. After all, we are in a war. We have, through no fault of our own, had to pick a fight against a virus where there is no human enemy and where the only way forward is together. See, this is the first time we're not fighting over race, religion, political agendas, or land. We are instead fighting for health, for freedom, for our right to exist and engage in human tribes. And for the first time ever, we are fighting with one dream united: to stop the virus. This human army is real, and human purpose, our desire to stay alive and well, is at the forefront of this mission. So who is David Burkus? David is one of the world's leading business thinkers. His ideas and best-selling books are changing how companies approach innovation, collaboration, and productivity. He is also a skilled researcher and inspiring communicator and award-winning author, and his TED Talk has been viewed over 2 million times. David's writings have appeared in The Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, USA Today, Fast Company, and many more publications. David believes that from battlefields to boardrooms and everywhere in between, leaders who frame their mission as a fight to be won against a threat that must be removed have been able to bring together even the most divided teams and push them to the highest levels of performance. Let's hope that this same approach is precisely what drives us to get through this trying time and to come out victorious in this age of corona, an era where our ability to fight with a purpose is exactly what will enable us to live through one of the most challenging periods of time in the last century. Welcome to the Decoding Purpose podcast, David Burkus.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're more than welcome. Now, David, I'm going to kick off with a question that I'm asking all my guests at a time when I think it matters the most. What is the first word or piece of advice that comes into your mind with regards to navigating the COVID-19 crisis in a purposeful way?
Yeah, I would say probably one of the biggest things is to ignore social distancing, not the medical prescription, but the term, and try and figure out how to be social while distant. One of the weird things that happened is a lot of people struggled when the whole pattern interrupt happened, and a lot of relationships fell by the wayside. We forget to contact this person. We forget to be in touch with that person. I've actually found that this is a weird time where when I need focused work time, I actually need other people for that more than I do when I know I'm going to see other people throughout my day. So like, I'm a writer by profession, and I literally now have a Zoom call, a web call with three friends of mine, and we all write together at the exact same time. We're all seeing each other. We're not talking. We're just doing that to try and stay a little bit social. Mm. I think when everybody is saying stay at home, lock down, et cetera, like I get it from a total medical and public health standpoint. I absolutely get it. But there are still ways that we can be social while distant. And doing that reminds us of why we're doing all of this to begin with.
Totally. You know, social isolation doesn't have to be emotional isolation.
Yes.
But I know also with your work, having done a little bit of research yesterday, I was watching your TED Talk, and the TED Talk was about networking. And you had a few really great tips in there with regards to, you know, reconnecting with dormant friends or connecting with the friend of the friend. And I will let you share some of those ideas. But I thought that was interesting, given that in some ways, this time is the perfect time to get out there and re-engage with your network.
Yeah, you know, that's been one of the most interesting things over the last 6 weeks to 8 weeks or so is I've had a lot of people that are saying, hey, could you do a webinar? Could you do a virtual event for us talking about how we can do this networking connection thing remotely? And, you know, the tactics change, but the strategy doesn't. One of the biggest tactics was that idea that there's a lot of power in your dormant ties, the people you know, but you haven't talked to in a really long time. And yet it's often so awkward to reach back out to those people, because I call it the clock of awkwardness. The longer a period of time goes since you've talked to somebody, the more awkward it is to reach back out to them. So the number one question I always get is, well, what should we talk about? What should we say? And there's all sorts of different tactics and strategies to come up with what to say. But we live in a really interesting time. Right now, you could send a message to anyone in that dormant tie category, and you could send them 5 words. How are you holding up? And that message would spark a conversation with just about anybody, right? Because we all need to be checked in on, and we all need to be checking in on each other. So in a time where normally when you reach back out to dormant ties, people are like, oh, well, what introduction do you want? Or what job referral do you want? Or why are you contacting me? Are you trying to sell me essential oils or something like that? What are you trying to sell me on? Now is a time to be able to, I mean, you got to be authentic. You can't fake this. But if you genuinely care about these people, you don't have to worry about what to say. Just check in on them, because that'll be well received by just about anyone.
Your latest book is Pick a Fight, How Great Teams Find a Purpose Worth Rallying Around. And as I mentioned before the podcast, I got very excited when one of my friends sent me your profile and your book. Now, you know, I think the topic itself, I would have interviewed you anyway, just because it's right in my sweet spot. But there is definitely another layer to this with COVID-19. Now, I can't imagine you knew at the time of writing this book that humanity would literally have a war to fight, a war, you know, unlike any we have known before, and that our purpose would literally be to take down a virus. So, you know, how has your perception of your own book and how has your core message evolved in the wake of coronavirus?
Oh, no, I planned this whole thing. I'm totally kidding. Yeah, I had no idea.
How weird is that? Like, I mean, you couldn't have written a more poignant book.
Thank you. I mean, I will tell you this. My evidence that I had no idea is that we released it in partnership with Audible as an audiobook. And you get it anywhere else, anywhere audio. You can download an audiobook, but you can't get it in print. You can't get it on ebook. And the idea was that leaders are busy. Let's do something that, you know, people are reading with their ears more and more now. Let's do something they can listen to on their commute. Well, everybody stopped commuting. Let's listen to something they can do while they're working on everything else. Well, now everyone's on endless Zoom calls. And so, you know, that proves that I had no idea that this timing would come forward. But yeah, I mean, at the core, the book kind of explores this idea that humans have always responded to natural disasters, terrorist attacks, things like this, you know, pandemics, COVID, the COVID crisis, with more pro-social behavior, not less. The idea that there is something outside that is threatening the community, however you define that community, connects the community more than it separates them. And in fact, often we find a way to get communities that seem to be adversarial together is to point out that larger thing that is either threatening them or a purpose, directing them in a way towards a brighter future. Those things bond people together faster. And I was writing it about companies. I was writing it about businesses that, you know, we do a really bad job conveying the mission statement into something clear and concise and lets everybody know how their own individual job, I call the question, what are we fighting for? We want to be able to let people know how each of their jobs answers that question, what are we fighting for? But yeah, I had no idea that we would see this thing where the entire world is united in one fight. I mean, I see a lot of people try and say, oh, this is similar to, this is our biggest challenge since World War II. Well, World War II was still half the world fighting the other half of the world. That's still a rivalry problem. This is literally the entire world bonded together. And we've seen, you know, one of the big things I always point out, my wife is an ER physician, and so we talk about the medical side a lot of times. And one of the things we always see is everybody says, okay, we might have a vaccine in 18 months. We've never had a vaccine in 18 months. It's been 5 years has been the quickest time that it's taken to develop a vaccine. However, I think 18 months is accurate because we've never had the entire planet and every company that knows anything about antivirals and vaccines, et cetera, all working together. We have no idea what kind of innovation we can unleash when we're all together. My big hope moving forward is what do we do when this is over? And we, you know, when we win, and we will win, what do we focus on next? Because we've done this great service of mobilizing the world. How do we get it mobilized to tackle the next challenge instead of just devolving back into things like world wars where it's still half versus the other half?
Yeah, you know, it's such a interesting time because, you know, we obviously have the coronavirus, which has given us this huge example of the whole world coming together to fight in this war against the virus. But what I find interesting is that it's also happened where we have emerging technologies and we have digitization and we have the scale and the density for people to come together all over the world and to be able to really amplify the solution with all of these new technologies at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I think about human history, and there's probably have been situations where we as a people have faced this, but we never knew it because of the slow roll of communication, et cetera.
Right. So, David, I think it's fair to say that coronavirus is a fight that has found us. But the interesting thing about that is it's also asked us to fight, you know, to find our own fight on a personal level. So for some, you know, that battle has become internal. For example, living in isolation has a long list of challenges, with mental health being one of those concerns. We have the fight for keeping our jobs or our businesses alive, and we also have the fight for our freedom and our sense of safety in the world. In the time, you know, before COVID, I think it's fair to say we were in an age of abundance, but now that abundance doesn't even feel as certain. So, in your opinion, what does this mean for purpose? Will we care for the fight more, or will we, you know, need to prioritize our own survival? Will that trump purpose?
So this is the big question that I'm asking a lot of leaders, right? I mean, I think this has certainly interrupted a lot of our patterns, and there is, you know, there's this term new normal. It's impossible this early to predict what the world will look like a year from now, what things have changed and what haven't, right? And I want to stress that too, is some things won't change. Humans are great at putting pieces back together and moving on like nothing ever happened. We have, you know, we have hurricanes and floods that knock houses off of cliffs and flood, and then we build them right back, right? We're great at that too. I don't know which ones we're going to do. What I can say with definitivity is this. We just asked, I mean, think about the professional class. We'll just think about sort of white collar knowledge workers, et cetera. We've asked all of them to adapt to this new remote system that companies were struggling with for 20 years. We've had the capability to separate presence from productivity for decades, but we never went along with it until we had to, which is right now. So on the company side, they're going to have to get used to that element. On the individual side, we're doing that, right? We were forced into this situation for that sense of purpose, because this global fight sort of found us. And I think it's a mistake if, as a leader, you think, oh, well, when this is over, we'll just get back to the way things were in terms of that purpose. No, I think you're going to need to point your people to what that next sense of purpose is. I mean, the mere act of logging into a Zoom call right now because you are socially distant and that saves lives, the mere act of that is an act of fighting against this enemy. People are going to need that same sense of purpose, that same connection, what in the psychology literature is often referred to as task significance, that same knowledge that doing those tasks has a larger purpose to it. They're going to need that more. I don't think that once we start scratching that itch, I don't think it's going to go away. I think people are going to ask for it more.
So, I mean, David, that's a great segue to the next part of my conversation. And I want to move away from COVID for a moment and dive into the content of your book, because, as I said, that alone I find incredibly exciting to talk about. It's certainly my area of passion. You know, when we think of this idea of picking a fight, there's an energy that comes with that. with that in mind, you know, How do you experience purpose? What does it feel like to you?
Yeah, I mean, me personally, so I outlined three kind of archetypes or templates of fights in the book, and we can we can dive into those later. Me personally, I'm personally motivated by one that I call the underdog fight, which is sort of that fight to prove the doubters wrong or the haters wrong or that sort of thing. I don't know. I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which it, no matter where you are in the world, you know one thing. You know Philadelphia's greatest sports hero, who happens to be fictional. But you know Rocky Balboa, right? The original underdog from all of the Rocky movies. We have that same spirit about us. And so that's been kind of one of my purpose ones is I'm usually always that narrative that I'm pushing this message against this underrated message or this message that, that isn't loud enough. I'm pushing that against the noise of the crowd or even myself, right? People are underrating me as an author or speaker, whatever it is. For some reason, that's really motivating to me, right? And I think I wouldn't wish that on a lot of other people, but there are definitely people that are wired that way. Other people might be motivated by what I call the ally fight, which is actually, it's not about my fight at all. It's about those people and I'm fighting to help them win their battle, right? It all sort of varies on the individual, but that underdog thing, again, part of it is my Philly nature, but that's the one that really is my kind of personal narrative to use for purpose.
Yeah, no, I really resonated with that one. I actually have a question penned about that one later on because I did resonate with the underdog. So we'll definitely, I'd love to dive more into those archetypes with you further into the conversation.
Yeah.
What do you have any sort of process or steps that you would advise someone who's wanting to find their personal fight?
Yeah. I mean, so the first question that I ask for a lot of, when I deal with a lot of managers to figure out, I think it's a mistake actually to just pick one, right? I know it's called pick a fight, but it's a mistake to just pick one willy nilly. I think you've got to do some research and figure out which one is going to resonate with your people. I think this is actually a big misconception about leadership as a whole. We always talk about having a vision or purpose and then casting that vision and then getting quote unquote buy-in from your people. Well, if you have to sell them on your vision, You started like two steps behind. You should have started figuring out what vision would resonate them. When we look at great leaders throughout the world, they usually don't cast a vision and sell it to other people. What they do is put to words the vision that was already on the hearts and minds of the people they're seeking to lead, right? So I think it starts there. I encourage a lot of managers to just start by asking their people two questions. What do we do here and how does what you do help us do that? So if you're thinking about your day-to-day job, you can ask yourself those same two questions. What the organization that you're a part of, what do they do? Right? And then pay attention to your answer. Are you talking about how that organization affects the industry a lot? That might be indicative of one archetype. Are you talking about how it serves customers? That's indicative of another. Are you talking about how it's the underrated player and it's trying to change? That might be another one. That might be my Philly one, the underdog, right? And then the second, and I think the bigger question is, how does what you do help us do that? Which is literally a question about task significance. It's a question about, do you get to see on a day-to-day basis how the work that you're doing contributes to that larger whole? Because that's where it's in corporate America, corporate Australia. Do you guys use the term corporate Australia? I probably should have asked.
We do. No, you're fine.
in that corporate world, that to me is the bigger disconnect, is showing people how the work that they do aligns with purpose. And then since they don't see it, that feeling of purpose falls apart. So that second question, asking that of yourself first. And then usually what I find is you think about it for a while, you think about it for 3 or 4 minutes and the answer comes to you. Now you ask yourself, great, how can I remind myself so I can answer that question faster? How can I make sure that it might be that I need to interact with customers more. It might be that I need to be reminded or consuming stories about the industry so that I can see the injustice in the industry that I'm fighting against. Whatever the answer is for you, you want to be able to remind, you want to be able to have an instinctual answer to that question. How does what I do help us do that? And if you have to think about it for longer than 2 minutes or so, you don't yet. So you've got to be finding ways that you can remind yourself of that purpose, because I truly do believe that's the bigger disconnect. I think there's a lot of organizations that have a good mission, a good vision, but the disconnect is in showing your people how their day-to-day work helps them do that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with this statement more. And it's actually one of the reasons why I love the languaging around picking a fight. Because if you think about it, like, you can't give somebody a fight. They've got to find their own fight and then work out how that passion, how that fire fits in with your army. Like that, you can't reverse engineer that. And I love that you've done the work to really focus on the fight archetypes, for want of a better word, to enable people to understand what really motivates them so that they can then join the right army. I think that's so poignant. And I think it's so poignant for leaders to understand that as well. Now, David, in the book, you have a chapter on fight bonds, which, again, I think is probably a good segue from the last part of our conversation. And there was one sentence that jumped off the page at me, and the word said this: pick the right fight that threatens enough people and requires them to bond and they unite. So, again, this is poignant in the age of corona. That said, our organisations are not as clear-cut as all of humanity fighting a virus. It's far more personal. So, I mean, we've just spoken about the different purpose archetypes. How do you actually, within that though, create the energy or the momentum for your people to join the fight with that same level of passion? And I know you've just kind of touched on that a little bit, but I really want to understand how you really bring that army together.
Yeah. So this is the reason I choose the term fight. I mean, and trust me, I get a lot of flack from it from people that are, oh, fight. We don't want to be in a fight. We don't want to be in this too violent rhetoric, et cetera. I got an email from a reader of mine who was disappointed that I named it Pick a Fight. And I noticed in the response that she was sending that email from a Northrop Grumman email address. Northrop Grumman is a major North American defense contractor. They make weapons and vehicles that fight in war. So I thought that's a little bit interesting.
Yeah,
but I definitely
a little bit
get
ironic.
That. However, I couldn't avoid this idea of fight. And here's why, right? Mission and purpose, vision, these are all great terms, but they are all, here is what we're looking forward to. And they don't answer the question of what are the stakes if we fail. And a fight does, right? A fight is a mission and purpose that says if we do this, we will make the world a better place because of this. But the way that we'll make the world a better place is by removing something that is threatening the world, something that is an evil, an injustice, or something else. And So I find that it's incumbent on leaders to kind of point to both. And I know that sounds negative. You don't need to accentuate the negative. You can still spend more time talking about the positives, but it's important to remind people that we're not just doing this because we have this utopian vision. We're doing this because if we take no action, the consequences will be worse than what we do. And that in the research literature, we often refer to that as superordinate goals, which is the sentence that you're referring to, is kind of an explanation of how that works. When you can take, that's an organization that has full of silos and politics and turf wars and all that stuff that creeps up in large organizations. And you can start to talk about the mission and vision, not just in a way of here's what we're going to accomplish and why, but here is what would happen if we weren't working together on this. You'll find that you end up getting people to see the importance of forgetting about those stupid turf wars and all of that stuff much faster, because they see a sense of urgency. They see that, yeah, we need to get this together. We need to put aside these sort of petty differences and start working together on this, because now there are stakes.
Absolutely. And I think it also speaks beautifully to the grit and the resilience of purpose. Like it's not always, as much as it might be something that gives us joy, purpose is not always rainbows and unicorns. Sometimes, and I think, again, the age of corona is highlighting this beautifully, sometimes it requires a huge amount of strength and grit, and it requires that kind of the energy of the fight. It's why they use the term a fight for justice, for example. So I think the resilience aspect is so important and really captured in this language.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And trust me, I almost broke my thesaurus trying to find any other term for this, because I mean, I started out looking at this concept of mission and purpose and what actually bonds people. And I couldn't avoid the importance of that stakes, the importance of the idea that you're working against something. I use fight exactly. You said fighting for justice. I use it the same way that politicians often say they're fighting for the little guy. Like we're talking about revolutions, reformations, et cetera. Mm. And I couldn't find a word that would have the same effect. And I think the words we use are hugely important. I think half the problem is that terms like mission and vision and all of that are great, but they are vague because they don't communicate that flip side of what happens if we fail. And I think that's probably the big thing that's missing for why people don't internalize what they do, is they don't tap into that grit that you're talking about. They don't tap into those extra reserves of even energy, et cetera. They don't tap into that because they don't see that stakes piece. But when you can get them to do that, amazing things happen.
So I think, you know, when we look at the language around fight, I think often the assumption is that it's about fighting with someone, fighting with a rival, fighting with the other. And you've actually called this out completely in the book, and you have a whole chapter dedicated to it. So when I glanced over this chapter, it made me think about actually what's changed in the world. Why is it that traditionally we have always fought our competitors, whereas now the powerful fight is actually found in fighting for a cause? What has changed in the world?
Yeah, you could argue nothing. We just became aware of it, right?
Yeah.
I think for the longest time, it's that sort of tyranny of metrics, right? For the longest time, we were just worried about what we were doing as an organization. There wasn't good enough data really to capture a market and start talking about market share. That only really came around in the last, recently, but I'm talking about 50, 60 years, right? So it was up to individual metrics. We judged whether or not we're making progress on the mission by those individual metrics. And then the market share ability to track all of that came along, and what we can measure gets paid more attention to. And suddenly people started kind of incorporating that language. But I would argue that it probably didn't motivate people back then either. I mean, it tends to motivate senior leaders because they're probably going to end their career at that organization. But almost everybody else, especially nowadays, knows I'm going to go to work somewhere else too. So this whole us versus them thing doesn't work because I'm going to be them in a couple of years anyway. So, that might have changed. The pace of that switch quickens. Mm. But I don't know that it ever really did. I mean, there's a lot of research, and we dive into it in the book, around when a leader is trash talking a competitor, for example. The only person that gets motivated are the people on the receiving end of the trash talk. Your people don't get any more motivated, right? In fact, some of it suggests that when you're trash talking a competitor, it gets people on your side complacent because they're like, yeah, they do. They are terrible and we are great. So we shouldn't have to work as hard because we're going to win anyway, right? Whereas those people are actually motivated to prove you wrong, right? So you can tap into that. There's a lot of research that suggests that it motivates people to act unethically, which is a huge problem. But yeah, this idea that we should focus, and this is the biggest thing, I guess I'm trying to take back the word fight, right? Because I'm not talking about fighting for market share or fighting against competitors. I'm talking about that superordinate goal that is your industry, right? And what you want to either change in the industry or what the whole industry is trying to change in the world. I'm talking about that. Tap into that sense of bigger purpose, because then you have people like, a lot of thinking on your show is about that individual sense of purpose. Then you have people who now are attracted to your company because that bigger thing that you're fighting for taps into their individual purpose. And now we're aligned, right? I mean, I can't tell you in the 80s and 90s how much ink was spilled over this idea of how do we get people to internalize the mission? Here's an idea. Pick a mission that people will naturally be gravitated to, right? It seems so simple. And yet we're only now realizing how powerful it is.
Yeah. What you're talking about there is the basis for a movement, like a Me Too, for example, is what can the world own? What idea can the world own as their own?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's why, I mean, the one that I think people are most attracted to, I'm in the minority being in the underdog fight, but the one that people are most attracted to is that revolutionary fight, which is usually when it says society or the industry or whatever says this is acceptable and we refuse to accept that any longer. You think about any movement, Me Too, but you think about any revolution, reformation, et cetera, they all had that as the core. This thing that everybody said is acceptable, we refuse to accept that any longer. And so we're going to start acting differently. And that's something that a lot of people already have aligned. You'll find, again, to use that idea of tapping in to the mission and vision that's already on their hearts and mind, there are people already experiencing that frustration. That was the amazing thing about Me Too, right? It was one tweet, but yet everyone who read it was like, yeah, Me Too.
Yeah, I got
that happened
this.
To Me Too.
Yeah, exactly. So David, while we're here, you've mentioned the revolutionary. We've had a bit of a chat about the underdog. What were the other archetypes there?
Yeah. So the third and final one is the ally fight, which is actually, it's actually not your fight at all. It's their fight, right? So the ally fight literally says it's not about us and our fight. It's about their fight and what they're fighting for and how we help them win. And the good news is you get to pick they. You get to choose what they is. They, most often it's a customer, but they can be something else. They can be a stakeholder. They can be the planet. They can be future generations. They can be whatever you want. But it's when you point to some other group or community that benefits from the work that you do, and you can say, you know what we do basically lets that happen. To give you the easy example, like I said, my wife is an ER physician, so she is an ally fight person, right? It's not about her and what she's fighting. She's not trying to change anything in medicine, but every day, I mean, right now she's in that COVID fight, but every day she's still fighting to keep people alive. That is a pure, it's about what they're fighting for, and I come along and help that. And I think a lot of leaders can benefit from that. The research literature on this is what's known as pro-social motivation, the motivation to help others, which is really, I mean, we talk about extrinsic and intrinsic motivators all the time and which one is better. And I mean, it's always intrinsic. If you don't know that by now, I can't help you. But inside of intrinsic, we don't talk about those different levers that you can use inside of intrinsic. And pro-social motivation is very quickly becoming one of the most powerful levers inside of intrinsic motivation that you can use as a leader.
Can you talk me through pro-social motivation? Because I heard a video or an interview you did where you spoke about it in detail and that it was actually a research report or a study. From memory.
Yeah. Yeah. This is actually the mega professor, the brilliant researcher, Adam Grant, who everybody knows from Give and Take, which everybody actually sort of internalizes as I should be a giver. I should help people around us. Most of Adam's research when he was doing his doctoral work and right afterwards was in this field of pro-social motivation. And one of the big takeaways was how to use this to motivate employees to take certain actions. So, for example, probably his most famous study is the University of Michigan here in the United States call center study. So a lot of the state schools, the bigger schools in the United States have these work study programs where current students get a scholarship. And one of the things that they do is they call alumni and they ask alumni for donations or ask alumni to donate to certain projects or just the general fund or whatever. And it is you can imagine, I mean, you are smiling and dialing. You're asking for donations. You're really selling, right? You're selling people on why they should. It's not the most motivating thing for an 18-year-old who just came here to get a degree to do, but it's a viable work study thing. In fact, there's a famous, Adam always talks about, he came to visit the call center for the first day and he saw this sign and the sign said, it was just in one of the employees' cubicles. It said, doing a good job here is like wetting your pants in a dark suit. You get a warm feeling, but nobody notices, right? So he's really disturbed by this fact. And so he starts to figure out what are the ways that we can get people to be reminded of the larger good that they're fighting. He designs this study whereby one of the arms of the study, the call center workers actually take a break and go meet with a student who was a direct recipient of a scholarship that they in the call center help fund every year with these calls for donations. So they got to see every time they pick up the phone and every time they call someone, it helps pay that person's tuition so that he can have a better future for himself, right? Now we've answered the question, what is he fighting for? And now I am helping him. That's the ally fight. So Grant was probably the first person to coin this term pro-social motivation. It's not the motivation to work for your own reward, which is extrinsic. And it's not necessarily the motivation to work because you enjoy the work, which is intrinsic. It's that you enjoy knowing that that work benefits somebody else. That is pro-social motivation.
So David, I want to talk about sustainability in the fight. And I'm going to swing back to COVID here for a minute, because you mentioned before it could take, say, up to 2 years for us to get a vaccine. For many of us, we've been in lockdown for quite a few months now. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty around this. So whether our fight is COVID or another purpose, how do we stay strong? How do we harness resilience? How do we stay in this for the long run?
Yeah, well, I think there's two big things, right? You have to tell people to fight what they're actually fighting for.
Yeah.
And then you have to be able to connect the plan that you're asking them to do to that fight. So, I mean, I'll give you a great example. And every country, depending on the decision of leaders, even every province or state is dealing with this a little bit differently. So I don't want anyone to think I'm targeting your leader. I'm just targeting a general thing that I'm noticing, which is that when this started, we had a very clear reason for lockdown, for social distances, et cetera. It was, if this thing replicates too rapidly, we're going to exceed healthcare capacity and excess people are going to die, right? Because we're not, just not going to be able to treat everybody who comes in to the hospital. We want to prevent that from happening. Well, now, as a lot of countries are opening back up, there's this disconnect, right? Because we're not saying, okay, we're opening back up, but here's the plan and here's how incorporating this plan will still keep people safe, right? So right now in the United States, as we're recording this, there's this big debate over whether or not we should be opening up, because some people are saying, no, stay locked down because we need to save lives. And other people are going, no, we're not going to come anywhere near exceeding that capacity, right? And this is really a leadership fault of saying, okay, the plan has changed. The fight has not changed, but often the strategy has to change. And I think there's a disconnect here in explaining how the new strategy is a result of change in circumstances and we're still on the same fight. And now I think there's some confusion. Some people are even saying, why are we locked down? What are we fighting for? And what happened there was basically people confused a change in strategy for a change in fight. It's not a change in fight, it's just a change in strategy. And making sure it's crystal clear that you're reminding people this is still what we're fighting for is huge, not only in this case in a healthcare scenario, but in an organization entirely. I mean, how many large companies basically feel like they have a flavor of the month program based on what the CEO or someone in the C-suite, based on some book they read in an airplane, right? I mean, I write those books, so I'm contributing to this problem to some extent, right? But how often are we in that situation? And what I think the problem is that in those situations where we're changing tactics, changing strategy a little bit, it's incumbent on leaders to go, no, the fight has not changed.
Yeah.
We just had this happen in the market or this happen in the greater environment. And so we need to change our strategy in order to keep winning the war.
Yeah. I mean, look, that's the anchor, isn't it? In times of uncertainty is exactly what you're talking about there.
Yeah. So it's not enough to, I mean, there's the fight, but then there's also, here is our plan for winning the fight. And that's both of those together clear up that uncertainty. And we had it when we first started. And I hope that we will have it again. I hope we'll continue to have it because Lord knows we need it.
So David, I have, I guess, a little bit of a selfish question for you. In the book, you spoke about the power of the underdog and you've also identified as an underdog, which makes you an even better person to have a chat about these two. So I relate to this based on my own past experiences. And for that reason, I also wonder, is that drive healthy? Does it come from a place of low self-worth seeking justice, or is it courageous and empowering? And how often does the underdog really win?
I mean, to some extent, it doesn't matter. I mean, I will tell you this. In terms of the research around this motivating power of the underdog narrative, there are two components that you need. And we've really talked about the first one, but I probably didn't do a good enough job talking about the second, which is it's not enough to have a rejection. You also need a rebuttal. You need a plan for how you're going to prove them wrong or why they're wrong, right? If you're just the little guy, you're just the David and the David and Goliath scenario, that doesn't help. You need a plan. I mean, if we use the biblical example, David's plan was to stand so far away Goliath couldn't touch him and shoot him with a sling. That's a good plan, right? But you need both components to be motivated. You need to know, they judged me as unworthy. Here's why they're wrong. And here's my plan for proving them wrong. If it's just the first part, I mean, they might be right. Quite candidly, a lot of situations that happened in my life offended me in the moment. And then later I realized, yeah, I probably wasn't ready for that situation. Mm. It wasn't them misjudging me. They were actually right. But when they're wrong, and when you can very clearly go, no, you didn't think this through. You ignored this thing, or you're just wrong because you don't see how hard I'm working, whatever it is. That's when you can start to tap into that motivating underdog narrative.
So let's have a chat about the allies, not as an archetype, but because what I want to understand is how we more broadly apply that mindset, because I think it's one thing to identify our own fight, but at the same time, such a big part of purpose is also about understanding the allies' fight. So the fights of our clients, our shareholders or our stakeholders, the fights of our communities, our friends or our family. So how do we hold space, acknowledge and respect the fights of our allies?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that the mistakes that leaders make in this case often is they just tell about the allies. They just tell about the stakeholders or the customers instead of, the thing that I love about the Adam Grant study is he didn't just tell them. Mm. He invited that person in, right? There's actually a lot of research on this. It's what's known as sort of that salience around task significance. Do people receive task significance better from hearing from their boss or the senior leader of the company, or do they receive it better from seeing the person who benefits? And it's almost always from seeing, right? But we don't often think about that in terms of what then becomes the leader's role. I actually talk about often now, if you're the leader and you're in the ally fight, your job isn't division captor. Your job is chief storyteller, right? Your job is to curate those stories and bring them to the people and share with them. Sometimes it means bringing the people in. Other times it means, what artifacts are you going to create that remind people of that fight? What things are you going to do that constantly remind people who those people are? So again, I mean, I'll give you an example because we're getting a little vague here. One of my favorite organizations in the world, they didn't make it into the book, but the gentleman who runs this organization is actually somebody who encouraged me to keep fighting for this idea, even when it looked like with my publisher and that sort of thing, it wasn't going to happen. His name's Jesse Cole. He's the owner of a minor league baseball team in Savannah, Georgia. So these are not the people that win the World Series. This is a summer league staffed with college players who just kind of get some extra practice while everybody has a good time. And his team is known as the Savannah Bananas. They're this fascinating. I mean, going to one of these, they will tell you they're fighting for the fans, right? They are very much the ally fight. And Jesse realizes that one of his jobs is to be that chief curator of all these different stories. So it happens in little things and in big things. In little things, like they often have the sort of secret shopper days where they go around and have somebody actually attend the game, not as an employee, but just as a staff member and make note of things. But they ask that person to wear a bright yellow pair of shoes, not so that they can see who the secret shopper is, but so that that person remembers that he or she is stepping into the customer's shoes in that moment. There's this little artifact, this little ritual that they do. Or then there's bigger stuff, like they play in a 100-year-old stadium, which in the United States means they played in a stadium that was built during a time of racial segregation. And there was a white section and a colored section. And there's a gentleman who goes to their games and said to him once, "I've been coming to this stadium since it was segregated." And they found that out. They figured that out. And they made this grand event where they basically said, "You know what? You have a lifetime ticket behind home base. Here is your seat. We're going to paint it. It's your seat, right? As long as you are here, you are welcome front and center, because this, we can't correct, we can't go back and fix what was done to you, but we can bring you back to the stadium in a way that says, no, we love you and accept you." They even ended up taking that player, and internally in the company, there's a mural of that man and his seat. So people walk by it and they get reminded of that story. So this, I think, is the key if you're going with the ally fight, is your job becomes chief curator. Your job becomes chief storyteller. It's your job to remind people of those things. They're there. They're already there. The disconnect happens when people get so lost in the clutter of their inbox and this web call and all of this stuff they have to do that they forget. They get disconnected from that very person that they're helping.
And David, what about the leaders out there who want to ignite a revolutionary narrative?
So then there's a very similar path, but your stories are a little bit different. You get to pick between stories of making progress and stories of the way the industry is failing people, stories of the way that the industry is taking advantage of people. And then the fun thing to me about the revolutionary fight is every metric becomes a symbol of progress if you remind people of that. So for example, they're not in the book either. They're another friend of mine, another person I consulted while writing the book to make sure I was clear. But not a story I captured. I am, as we're talking, I'm making a couple little notes about things I want to say on my phone. Wrapped around my phone is a case from a company called Pila. They're a Vancouver, Canada-based company, and they make cell phone cases. Big deal, right? Like lots of other people. The difference is their cell phone cases biodegrade in 10 years if composted. So every other smartphone and tablet case, et cetera, in the world is made from petrochemicals. It sits in a landfill for thousands of years after we throw it away because we got the newest version of the iPhone. Theirs are actually waste-free. If you ask anybody in the company, what are you fighting for? We're fighting for a waste-free future. That's their answer to it. And the beautiful thing about that, when you have that clear sense of, hey, the entire industry says it's okay to use these things because they're cheap and easy, and come on, it's just an acceptable cost of consumerism that we're going to trash the planet with all of these plastics. They say, no, it doesn't have to be that way. We can do it for pretty much the same cost of a cell phone case, all of that. There's no reason to do that because we have this technology. So we refuse to accept that any longer. And every sale, right? Every quarterly report with their sales, every one of those is a chart of progress and winning that war. So again, your role as a leader doesn't just become to remind people of the vision, but to point to those metrics and go, see, what this means is one less cell. Every sale is one less cell phone case in a landfill, one less little piece of garbage in the great garbage patch in the Pacific Ocean, right? It gets, to me, it gets really fun when you can do that, because then every one of your metrics has meaning.
And I have to say, in listening to all of your answers today, there is a core theme there around the power of narrative and storytelling with regards to how you inspire the fight. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little biased. I was an undergrad English major, right?
Well, then you know all about it.
but I mean, this is sadly one of the things. I mean, one of my prior books is called Under New Management, and it's about the ways that workplace practices are changing. This is one of them, this need to deliver purpose. But it starts with the story of Frederick Taylor and the Industrial Revolution and scientific management and the idea that we could measure and track all of this sort of stuff. Compared to where we were before Frederick Taylor, that was a huge revolution, right? Kickstarted the Industrial Revolution. It's the reason we have some of the technologies that we have. But there's a tyranny to metrics and measurement too, which is that meaning gets lost. And the only way to bring it back is with that storytelling, right? Not everything that can be measured matters, and not everything that matters can be measured. Some of it has to be flushed out in a story.
So, David, I've come to the last part of the podcast today. And my question firstly is how are you going? How are you and your wife going in the age of corona? How are you guys personally dealing with it?
How are we holding up? We talked about that right at the top. That's a good question. We're doing fine. I feel really weird. We don't have anything to complain about, right? I mean, yeah. it's a little scary in thinking about my wife and what she goes through, but we're both young. We have young children, right? Which means that our statistics, our chances, all of that are really, really low. Mm. It's been a little bit of a bummer trying to explain to the 8-year-old and 6-year-old why for a month they couldn't go visit Oma and Opa, right? The grandparents. But beyond that, like, you know, we're doing fine compared to the people that our businesses are closing down because of lockdown, or who know 7 or 8 people in their immediate family that have suffered through this. So I have nothing to complain about. I'm truly blessed. My big goal has just been, again, trying to use this crisis to wake a lot of people up to this importance of purpose. I'll tell you one sort of funny story since we talked on this is since this started, every night that my wife works, there's this weird ritual when she comes home, which is sort of the disinfectant ritual, right? So she comes home, she takes, we used to go back and forth between 2 different automobiles. Now she's just got the one, right? And if for some reason somebody has to get into it, we got to spray the whole thing down with disinfectant. She comes in, goes right to the laundry room, changes clothes off of all of that, disinfects everything. There's Lysol in the air for days afterwards, right? That whole thing. And it reminded me something really interesting, which is that everyone else's work life is sort of like that too. I mean, she's doing it because there's this incredibly deadly virus that's floating around in the air. But how many people drag some form of negativity or toxicity from their workplace, catch it, and accidentally bring it home with them?
Yeah.
Right? This to me makes purposeful workplaces, for example, so important. I wrote at the end of the book this idea that work-life balance doesn't matter, because if your work drains you, if you work in a toxic environment, if you work without purpose, you will drag that negativity to other areas of your life anyway, no matter how many hours you're spending at one or the other. And this little disinfectant ritual sort of reminds me of the importance that, I mean, arguably we need a disinfectant ritual before we go into our families and loved ones to get into that crap office. I would prefer to take that can of Lysol back to the workplace and disinfect all of the toxicity from that workplace.
So that's been
my
analogy.
Personal fight for a while.
Yeah, no, I love it. You know, it's interesting. I have a 2-year-old daughter as well, and I've often thought we teach hygiene, but we don't teach energetic hygiene. We don't teach our kids how to clear and wash their emotions or their mindset. And, you know, those transitions are so important, especially in leadership, because it informs how you show up.
Yeah.
Yeah,
totally.
And so my final question today, and it's a big one, but it's a simple one. David, what's your fight in this world? What matters to you the most?
I'm fighting to make work not suck. In an honest component,
yeah,
kind of like we just talked
that.
About, the through line through all of my work is that I'm trying to make work is, it's never going to go away. Work is central to our experience as humans. It's something that we do even when people don't pay us to do it. So that vocation, we draw a lot of meaning and purpose from it. So I feel like if we're going to do that, then it's incumbent on us to do it right, to do it in a way that adds energy, doesn't subtract energy, et cetera. So that's been my personal fight for a long time. I've never really declared it a fight until this book, but now I'm enlisting. I'm signing up recruits. So if you're with me, let's get to work.
I'm with you. You know, and we can certainly direct this podcast towards your personal fight. Happy to do that. So in this age where we are all visiting virtual homes and expanding our network, and now you're a friend and a friend of a friend, where can we visit you, David? Where are your virtual homes?
Well, I mean, if you're a regular listener to the show, then the single best place would be the show notes for this episode. Rebecca's got a beautiful website. It's got all sorts of resources on it. Start there. She wants you to go there anyway. But mine is davidburkus.com, BURKUS.com. But you're not going to remember that. You're listening to this, doing something else. You'll remember her. So go to her website and then we'll connect there.
Well, look, absolutely. But the one thing you can't buy on my website is the book. And I would highly, highly recommend that you do track down this book. I enjoyed reading every page. And you know, look, I've spent the last few years decoding purpose. And I genuinely found this perspective fresh, new, and it actually closed some knowledge gaps for me. I really feel like the piece around the different archetypes and how we connect to our own personal fight and then how we link that to an organizational mission was really a missing piece and one that I really took from this book. So I'd recommend any leaders out there go and pick up a fight.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me.
You are more than welcome. Thank you so much for joining me on the Decoding Purpose podcast. David Burke, it's such a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. If you have enjoyed the podcast, please take a moment to leave us a review. That would be greatly appreciated. And we'd also love you to join the Purpose Movement at Instagram by following us at Decoding Purpose Podcast. Also, a big shout out to our sponsors at Supernova Sound.